It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa has been through a lot of changes in the last 40 years. The farm crisis set off a chain reaction that continues to impact rural Iowa and urban Iowa today. And while some rural areas are doing well, others are still struggling and trying to cope with ever-dwindling populations. My first guest today has some pretty radical ideas for how to turn things around in rural areas. Robert Wolf is a writer who lives in Decorah. He's the founder of Free River Press and the author most recently of a short book called Building the Agricultural City, a book that fleshes out ideas he's been working with for more than two decades now. And Robert Wolf is with me. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the title of the book is Building the Agricultural City, which in a nutshell kind of puts a nice title on your idea, but you are going to have to spell it out for us. This is about regionalism. So tell me what your vision is for an agricultural city.
Right. It's basically a cluster of cities that would work cooperatively on economic and cultural development. And I live in the Driftless region, which, as you know, is comprised of portions of four states: northeast Iowa, southeast Minnesota, southwest Wisconsin, a little bit of northwest Illinois. And so I can envision five or six agricultural cities within that region, and they would be, each would be a generator to create a larger regional economy.
All right. So spell it out. A lot of people are familiar with the Driftless region in Iowa. You live in Decorah right now. So let's make this a concrete idea. If you had the power to build an agricultural city in that part of the state of Iowa, tell me about the communities that would be a part of it and what it would look like.
It'd be the four counties of the four northeasternmost counties, which would be Clayton, Fayette, Allamakee, and Winneshiek. And what I think one thing that needs to happen is there has to be a quarterly meeting of mayors, city managers, and economic development people to begin coordinating things. But I think the main generator is going to be folks outside of government. This is not going to be something that's generated by local county or municipal governments. It's going to have to be truly a grassroots movement. And I'll say that there's enough disaffection with the current state of affairs that people are now accepting the idea that regionalism is the only effective counter to globalism. We need to create a productive economy, substituting for this service economy that we have. So with the service economy, we're just buying goods from the outside, and which continues to impoverish us. We're not producers. We need to create light industry here. And I want to see worker-owned cooperatives, since that would democratize the economy, or that'd be one way to democratize the economy. We could have farmers working together. Furniture and cabinet makers, ceramicists, and so forth. I could go on. I could say that.
Well, so when you talk about these communities coordinating and working together, what kinds of coordination are you talking about?
Okay, for one thing, the region itself needs to have a website, so there's internal communication. That is, you would have all trades and professions within a certain group, listed individuals and organizations listed, so that they could make easier contact, or if they did not know of each other's existence, the website would help them, so that if furniture and cabinet makers decided that they wanted a cooperative showroom, they could begin talking about that, might begin making sense. Also, we need to market outside the region, not only our goods, but we need to attract youth and others, entrepreneurs, to the region. We have to develop the culture. We don't have the cultural amenities that are that would retain youth within the region. The Des Moines Register a number of years ago said that that was the greatest reason for the out-migration of Iowa youth, was lack of cultural amenities. So this for so many of the very conservative-minded Iowans, this is something radically new. I mean, if we do not try to infuse the populations with new energies, with new people, newcomers, new ideas, the towns will continue to stagnate and wither. In Northeast Iowa, our towns have been losing population for decades now, and there's nothing to reverse it nothing to reverse it right now.
So you want to go even farther than having craftsmen or farmers or people in different parts of the economy work together. You also write about creating a local currency. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Now, local currencies will work up to a point, they're limited by the fact that retailers can't pay their suppliers with a local currency.
Well, before we talk about whether they work or not, explain what a local currency would look like. What is a local currency?
Well, it's paper money that's printed up in your town or your county, and then you get individuals, shopkeepers, suppliers of various kinds to agree to accept that, and you want that to circulate. You want it. It's an attempt to keep money circulating within your locale.
All right, and it's not based on our national currency. I mean, there are other ways to earn local currency, right?
Right. I mean, Ithaca, Paul Glover up in Ithaca, New York, founded perhaps the first or most recent. He started a trend that developed. It was, I don't know how many decades back, but Ithaca dollars is I think it's, someone else can explain. I've forgotten what, you know, Ithaca dollars worth so much of a U.S. dollar, and everyone is given so many, like maybe so many Ithaca dollars to begin the trade.
And so people can earn them by performing tasks for other people, like I'll do some carpentry work for you, you'll do some babysitting for me. It creates sort of an economy within the economy, right?
That would be a time bank. That's okay. Another great way. That's another great way of promoting getting people into the economy who otherwise would be sidelined. So, yeah, so a time bank calls for a registrar, someone to run a registry in which all the members of the time bank, all participants are listed, and you can arrange directly for a trade, a one-on-one trade, and everyone's hours are worth the same amount. 1 hour of babysitting is worth 1 hour of carpentry. There are other methods of doing this. The LET system, which is another kind of time bank, is you negotiate what your time is worth. And if I negotiate with a roofer and he's going to charge me $5,000 to do part of my roof, then I am indebted to the system to perform $5,000 worth of service or work of some sort, and he has $5,000 of credit. And so if the system's going to survive, people have to come forward and perform service for him. As he lists what services he needs, then others can respond and fulfill those services. The ideal is to bring everyone's balance down to zero.
So, okay, in addition to trying to create sort of an economy within an economy, I mean, the idea is that in creating these worker cooperatives, in having local governments work together, in bringing some light industry to the area, you're trying to create a closed circuit. I mean, that's the idea, right? That you're not going to be buying a lot of goods, services, and food from outside this region, right?
You want to reduce it as much as possible, but on the other hand, you want to sell outside the region. You want to sell nationally, and you want to sell globally. That would be the ideal. The ideal is expressed in, it's manifested out in the Emilia-Romagna region of northern Italy, which is one, Emilia-Romagna is one of 20 administrative districts in Italy. And they have thousands of worker-owned cooperatives. That region has a long history of craftsmanship, a heritage of craftsmanship, and the history of the labor movement. So that these cooperatives are relatively small. My understanding is that there may be approximately 20 people might be a large cooperative. But if they get an order, they have a lot of ceramicists, for example. And if an order comes in from China, because they get a lot of Chinese orders for some of their high-end ceramics, the order is then shared among all the other ceramic cooperatives, fulfilling production orders, distribution, whatever. And all business there is done on a handshake. Now, the Emilia-Romagna produces the Ducati, the Lamborghini, the Maserati, and a few other very high-end sports cars, and I think it's either the most or the third most prosperous region in Italy, and has one of the highest qualities of life in Europe.
So when we're talking about these regional economies, it sounds a lot like what we do as the state of Iowa. Do you feel like states are too big?
Yeah, there's no identification. I mean, I don't identify with Iowa as much as I do with the Driftless region, and I know a growing number of people in the Driftless region identify more with the region than they do with their respective states. I find it hard to identify with someone in Pella, Iowa, let's say, or Sioux City, but I can easily identify with people within my own region, and it's the topography that gives us this sense of our method of farming, or what the method of farming was until recently.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Robert Wolf. He's a writer who lives in Decorah, and he has just written a short book called Building the Agricultural City. It's about regional economies. We'll talk more in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about regional economies. We're talking about rural economies. With me right now is Robert Wolf. He's a writer who lives in Decorah, the founder of Free River Press, and the author most recently of a short book called Building the Agricultural City. It's a book about how to develop a regional economy, some ideas about the problems that might solve for rural areas that are struggling and seeing their population decline, which, of course, is a problem in many rural parts of Iowa. Also joining us now is David Peters. He is an associate professor of sociology at Iowa State University, and he specializes in rural sociology. Hello, David.
Hello, Charity. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being here today.
No problem. Happy to be here.
And now, of course, you have studied many rural areas in the state of Iowa and around the country. I want to start with, and Robert's still here with us, so you guys will have an opportunity to interact with each other. But I want to start with the question. I mean, rural areas are struggling. We've seen this over a period of the last 40 years, but there are some rural areas in Iowa that we know have really found ways to survive and even to thrive. So first, give us a little bit of a report card. How are we doing in rural Iowa right now?
Sure. So as you said, in general, rural Iowa is fairly prosperous compared to other rural areas of the United States. Our poverty rates are 3 to 4 percentage points lower than the national average in our rural areas. Our median incomes are much higher than the standard rural income across the United States. We have well-developed institutions, particularly the public school system and other social and health services. Now, when Iowans, of course, say they wish their government could perform better, or they wish the schools could be better, and so on, you have to keep in mind that the level of quality of those services is fairly high, so the expectation is higher than it is in other parts of the country. So in general, rural Iowa is doing fairly well compared to the rest of the nation. However, when you look at individual communities, there is some variation. So some communities have really gone into a tailspin in terms of population decline, decline of local industries, and that is a major issue. But we've also seen communities that have experienced similar decline, but their quality of life has actually increased over the past 20 years. So at Iowa State, I run a study that's been surveying 99 small towns in Iowa since 1994, and we call these shrink smart communities. They're communities that have had well below average, sort of, they had much faster declines in population over the past 20 years than your typical Iowa town. But contrary to what you'd expect, the quality of life has increased in a very small number of these towns. And so right now we're trying to investigate why this is. And I think Robert mentions this in his book, that this notion of social capital becomes very important, that these towns, despite declining populations, despite declining numbers of jobs, have actually able to maintain a very high and actually growing level of quality of life. And we see that's relatively unassociated with income and jobs, but it's really linked to civic engagement, public participation in the community, and these social bonds in the community.
So, okay, that's one of the things that sets these communities apart.
Yeah.
But you can't just create that in
that's
a
correct.
Community. So what went right?
Well, part of it, so part of it is just idiosyncratic, that these towns either had a long history of working together, usually what we've been finding in our initial analyses is that these towns have had some sort of event, some sort of shock to the community that really drove them together. Most communities in the United States, even in the upper Midwest, are much more individualistic than, say, they are in Europe, where there's much more of a stronger communitarian tradition. But usually when there's some disaster, natural disaster, or maybe an economic disaster, that tends to pull people together for a common cause. And people pull together for that particular event, but those social bonds persist. And oftentimes that's a basis for tackling other issues, such as the economy or maintaining health services or senior services in the community. So what we find is that these shocks tend to really, the unintended consequence is that it drives people together. And that can be, you know, experience a tornado or a flood, while materially that's damaging, socially there tends to be some long-term benefit to experiencing a disaster like that.
So the communities that don't have this kind of social capital, this kind of civic engagement, can we also look and say what went wrong? I mean, I know many communities are fear for their future when they lose their school, for example, because the school is very much a community center. That's where people come together. That's where that kind of civic engagement starts.
Yeah. So there's a lot of those in Iowa, so it's hard to summarize, generally speaking. But if I were to summarize those towns that had declining populations and sort of declining quality of life, I would say there's a general sense of they've given up. So these towns are aging rapidly. You have the leadership class in a lot of these rural Iowa, in a lot of these small towns in Iowa, are in their late 60s, early 70s. They're going to retire soon, either retiring out of sort of public life in the community or retiring somewhere else outside. And there's not been that younger pipeline of leaders willing to take up the charge. So these are the people that have been, for the past 30 or 40 years, been trying anything and everything to try to revitalize the town, and they haven't been successful. They're retiring, and the sense in a lot of these communities is, you know, that's it. We've tried a lot of things. We're losing that group, that baby boom generation that's really invested heavily in the community. We're going to lose those people in a few years. Either they're going to retire or they're going to move out of the community, and there's no one left to sort of take up those projects. It's exasperation is the sense that we get when we talk with local leaders and individuals write comments on their surveys.
Well, and Robert, you write quite a bit about that as well. I mean, for your idea to work, you need new people to come into the area. You need those young people to come in and become engaged with their community. We see civic engagement among young people, even in urban areas, at low levels. So do you have ideas about how to bring those people? What can rural areas do to attract those people?
Yeah, first let me say that we don't have the kind of prosperity that your other guest, I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Oh, David.
David.
That's all right.
We don't have that kind of prosperity that he's talking about here. In our four northeast counties, we have a lot of empty storefronts. Postville now has about 80% of its storefronts empty. The other towns are indeed struggling. Even Decorah now has more empty storefronts than it's had in a long time. So, yes, there's a need for young people to come in and replace that older leadership. And I would say what I would do, what I want to see done, as I said before, is have a website that for our region that would make it attractive to young people. I think that, for example, if I were one of the leaders in one of our small towns that had empty apartments above stores on Main Street, I'd say, okay, we're going to, Mr. Store Owner, we're going to give you a tax abatement. You're not going to pay taxes for a year, but you have to host free of charge, rent-free, a young artist or a writer from Chicago, Minneapolis, New York. And in exchange, that artist has to do public works projects, has to give classes, has to give arts classes, has to engage a good number of people in some public arts work. That's being done in some of the big cities, such as Boston. We need that kind of energy here.
And David, as you look around the state, I mean, there are communities that are doing things like that. Do the communities that are doing well, do you feel like there's an emphasis on trying to make it attractive for young people?
Yeah, I would say the emphasis is more on just making the community attractive.
For all people?
For all people, yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, you know, getting young people, I guess when we talk about young, you know, we would typically say people under 25 or maybe people under 30. It's particularly difficult to attract those people to small towns. It's even difficult for them to retain that young population. And why is that? You know, one, the educational system is particularly good in Iowa. Most of the young people have very strong work ethics, and there's a lot of employment centers near Iowa, Minneapolis, Chicago, Kansas City, Omaha, and so on, that pulls those people away. And then there's also that most people that leave, they have no real issue or problem with the towns they came from, but they're young. You know, they grew up in that town, they want to go out and experience the world. So a lot of the efforts have been on not trying to keep these 20-year-olds or even people in their early 30s, but really trying to bring them back once they're in their mid to late 30s to come back to Iowa when they begin families or they become more settled. So a lot of the efforts that I see in many small towns in Iowa is to bring back rural residents or people that have lived in rural areas when they're in their 30s and 40s, to when they're more established, ready to be
perhaps engaging. When they have young families.
Precisely. It's very hard to keep a 20-year-old when there's the allure of the city, and that's, you know, that's a story as old as these towns themselves. That's always been happening. But really, the effort is to how do you bring them back, and the methods they do that is to improve the quality of life of these communities, quality schools, quality health and social services, child care services, some semblance of a retail and entertainment sector. Those are the things that are going to drive people in. And up in northeast Iowa, you have fairly high natural amenities. It's a picturesque place by Iowa standards. Tilly, there's creeks. You know,
I think it's picturesque by any standard.
By any standards, okay. That's right. No, that's probably true. But that's a draw. That would be an asset of the landscape that these four counties in northeast Iowa could use to their advantage. They could use that landscape and the uniqueness of that landscape to as a way to induce people to come to those towns, as well as the quality of life and as well as some economic activity for them to be engaged in.
Well, and we're talking about regional economies. And Robert, you write about the local foods movement, which of course has grown a great deal in Iowa in recent years. And in some ways, I mean, this is kind of a microcosm of what you're talking about, where people are growing food locally, selling it locally, and that money stays in that region, right?
Right. So that becomes the model for other endeavors. Yeah, it's and we're trying to get more young farmers here, but it's difficult with land prices. And the older folks, as we know, the older farmers are retiring, and so the farms are going to get larger and larger. And we want to see, I mean, ideally we'd like to see smaller farms so that there would be more commerce in the little towns. One thing David left out of the cultural or the mix for attracting people are the cultural amenities. And I think that's the lack thereof is a big stumbling block. We just have to recognize that this economy is not serving everyone. And in fact, we had, you know, President Trump got in because there was disaffection in rural America with the global economy. And that's why we have to build a regional economy. I don't see any other, any other alternative.
Well, and so the problem is, of course, this is a radical restructuring of our economy. So some of the ideas seem like things that the people are excited about putting into place, although to radically restructure the economy is an incredible task. So I think we need to talk about the good ideas that can come out of this idea. I know, David, you also have concerns about a move toward regional economies. What are some of the things that kind of worry you about this approach?
Well, I guess first is that, you know, regionalism is sort of old wine, new bottles. I mean, there was a huge push for regionalism in the 1930s to promote economic and community development in response to the Great Depression. There was some semblance of regionalism in the late 19th century with the Grange movement and the farmer populist movements in the late 19th century. That kind of went out of favor in the 1950s and 60s when the Cold War was going on. There was a focus on nationalism rather than regionalism. And ironically, that's another point I want to make, but I can make that later, that this period of the 50s and 60s is seen as sort of a golden age in rural America, yet that was a period when regionalism was really on the wane and was trying to be, you know, what was being promoted were more national ideas. Then regionalism resurfaced in the 70s as sort of an anti-government, Nixon, Vietnam, there was sort of that anti-government movement, and regionalism became more stable. But I think the biggest barriers are, you know, one, I would argue, and of course I have no data to back this up except my own speculation, is that most Americans and people in small towns tend to think not in regional terms, but mostly in terms of their community or their state or along a race or ethnic line. One feature of Iowa is that people feel very strongly their attachment to their communities is very strong. And so I don't really see a very strong attachment to regions, particularly in Iowa. Now, if you talk about a state like Missouri, where there's a lot of different cultural regions, or Minnesota, where you have an entirely different climatic region. In Iowa, there's not a lot of differentiation to really, I would say, distinguish cultures or regions in Iowa to any large degree that you find in other states.
And we have just about a minute and a half left. And David, though, I'd love to get your thoughts on moving into the future, because it sounds like you don't think we can move back in time. But, you know, as Robert was writing about the regional economy, local foods is growing. That's brought some new life into some areas of the state where there hadn't been new life for quite some time. Mm-hmm. So as you look to the future, what do you think are some things that could change in Iowa that might strengthen our rural areas?
I would argue that, well, first let me say that, I know I have to be quick, regionalism, I think, is in general a good idea, but I think it's one of degrees and in particular areas. So like food systems clearly is an area that Iowa can develop these regional economies. Things like manufacturing, I'm less I'm less sure if that can that's feasible. What I think is a better way is, instead of talking about regionalization, talk about bringing back some of the regulations that were in place in the 50s and 60s. Robert, I think, rightly talked about large segments of the population being left behind in a global economy. I think one point would be to go back to some of those 50s and 60s and 70s era regulations that protected people much more than they do now.
All right. Well, we are out of time, but thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity.
Yep. Thank you, Charity.
David Peters is an associate professor of sociology at Iowa State University. Robert Wolf is a writer who lives in Decorah. He most recently has written a short book called Building the Agricultural City. Coming up in just a moment, we'll find out about a program that helps developmentally disabled people learn how to cook. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. This is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. There are many misconceptions about people with intellectual disabilities, and their abilities are constantly being underestimated. Sue Haas has found a unique way to help people with intellectual disabilities learn, invest in their health, and gain independence. She's one of the founders of Look, Cook, and Eat, a digital magazine designed to help people with intellectual disabilities learn how to cook. Hello, Sue.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for being here.
I'm thrilled to be here.
Tell me how the idea for this magazine came about.
Well, a couple of different paths. My youngest sister is, who's now 40 years old, was born with an intellectual disability. So I've always lived with that community and the understanding of that community and what their needs are. But it really sort of all came to fruition about 5 years ago when I began working with a coffee shop in my church called Plymouth Grounds, and it's a job training site for individuals, high school students in the Des Moines metro, with intellectual disabilities. And part of my work there included baking one-on-one with the student baristas, and I discovered that they really, really loved to cook. And so I did a little investigating and found out that the resources available to their teachers were somewhat limited, and I took an idea back to my business partners. We have a food media company and have a long history of food magazine publishing, so we have a good understanding of that particular genre. And I said, what do you think about this cooking magazine for people with intellectual disabilities? And so we sort of just ran with it, and Look, Cook, and Eat was launched last October.
How does it work? You can go to the website. You need to subscribe. But what do you get in an issue of Look, Cook, and Eat?
In an issue of Look, Cook, and Eat, you get 9 menus, and each menu has 3 different recipes in it. Every recipe is depicted in 3 different parts. You have the foods you need to cook the that particular recipe. And they're shown in the ingredients. There's big pictures and voiceover of the ingredients. There's also a written piece, so you can see what the word looks like in case reading is not an issue for some students, but it is for some. So we try to usurp any kind of reading problems that way. And then you go to a tools page and you get to see all the tools that you need to make the dish. And in both of those instances, you never have more than 9 ingredients or 9 tools. So we try to limit the scope of things that way. And then in the third piece, there are up to three videos that basically take the user from start to finish to cook the dish. And then you end with a finished product. So it's all kind of depicted pictorially and through video and voiceover.
Well, and we were just talking about how a lot of young people these days don't learn how to cook, and so maybe they only know how to make macaroni and cheese. And I think that young people and people with intellectual disabilities probably get underestimated in their abilities in the kitchen and get taught to make very, very simple things, even when they're capable of more.
Right.
So give me an idea of some of the kinds of recipes you've put in the magazine.
Oh, my gosh. We have Sloppy Joe sliders. So we make Sloppy Joes and we put them on little buns. We have regular sliders too. And we've got roast chicken and mushrooms. We have panko crusted pork chops with baked sweet potatoes. We have taco salad or Chinese chicken salad. And so it's all real food. All of the groceries can be purchased in one stop at a kind of normal grocery store. And it's cooking. We don't play it down. We want people to eat real food, and we don't make our salads look like bunny rabbits or anything like that. So hopefully the user is engaged throughout the process and can find something in that menu that will resonate with them and create some excitement around the dish.
Well, and I realize that a lot of people are using your magazine with younger students, maybe in junior high age, 12 and up, but it's really geared toward older students, right?
It's geared toward anybody who's a little bit afraid of the kitchen. We try to calm any kind of fears and show people how to use the burner. We are very distinct about, turn your burner to high, 9 or 10 if your stove has numbers. We get really specific about how to work a particular piece of equipment. And all of the equipment is pretty basic. We haven't used a food processor or anything like that. So most basic kitchens will have these items. And we really try to calm and any fears. Yes, things are hot. Yes, things are sharp. But we believe you can do it. And if you just watch and go slow, you can do this.
I want to bring Karen Lamb into the conversation now. She is a special education teacher at Indianola Middle School, and she's been using Look, Cook, and Eat with her students. Hello, Karen.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here. And how have you been using Look, Cook, and Eat in your classroom?
Well, we use Look, Cook, and Eat in several ways. We use it almost weekly to teach those cooking skills. But we also use it as a vehicle for teaching academic skills and to increase inclusiveness and interaction with their general education peers. So my students, during Look, Cook, and Eat sessions, they select a menu. They write their own grocery lists. They have to vote for which menus they want, and sometimes that gets a little contentious.
But right. heated arguments.
That's good to teach, right? That. They go into the grocery store, purchase the items, look at budgeting, look at consumer skills, and then we come back into the classroom and make that healthy meal. And then we, as much as possible, try to share that meal with either other staff or other students. So it's really, we use it as really a comprehensive tool in teaching life-centered education. Tomorrow we're actually making a Thanksgiving dinner for approximately 50 people,
wow,
both staff and students. And we're using those skills that we learned through Look, Cook, and Eat. Not just the cooking skills, but also those socialization skills that comes through cooking to present to the school, to show people exactly the many abilities that our students have.
Well, and you mentioned academic skills. I can imagine there would be math skills involved in this and making your shopping list. I mean, not only planning skills, but also you can work a little language arts in there too, right?
Oh, absolutely. After we make a menu, we go back and we review what went well, what didn't go well, whether or not this is something that we could use in the home, what changes we would make so we can incorporate those higher order thinking skills. Most of the time, we do double and triple our recipes just so that we can bring in multiplication and repeated addition for the kids to use. Even looking at the different ethnicities of some of the recipes, we can engage in a social studies lesson as well. So really, it is a comprehensive, it's absolutely a wonderful program because it does lend itself to so many different areas of education.
Have you already been able to see some of your students taking these skills home and using them with their families?
Oh, absolutely. We made pancakes earlier this year, and then we made pancakes for a peer group. And then I was happy to get a note from a student's parents that says, you know what? My child just over the weekend made pancakes for us. I said, she goes, I never thought that she would be cooking. And here she comes and she wanted to make pancakes. And we had no idea if she could do it or not, but she went and did it. And so to me, that's thrilling that they're taking those skills in the classroom. And not only are they doing them at home, but they're thrilled to do them at home and to share them with other people.
Well, and I can imagine you mentioned having more gen ed students, general education students, come and get involved as well. I mean, this is a food is an incredible motivator. So is this sort of a social lubricant, too?
Oh, absolutely. It is so much fun to see general education students come on down and say, hey, you know, we're here, you're making this. You know, can we help? How do we help? And even what's even more thrilling is to have general education students look at special education students and said, wow, I don't even know how to do that. Yeah. You know, teach me how to do that. How do you do that? And so I just think it's food is such a vehicle to bring people together that it's just amazing to see.
Well, and Sue, listening to Karen talk about using Look, Cook, and Eat in her classroom, did you expect that when you came up with the idea for this magazine, that this is something that could be used in schools as well as in homes?
I was hoping that would be the case. And I got a lot of information from teachers through this coffee shop program because they special education teachers would send their students there. So I'd get to connect with the teachers. And I asked them, do you have something like this? And or what do you do to teach your students how to cook? And so many times they would say, oh, we just Google recipes and use those. And if anyone's ever Googled a recipe, you know that there are a million recipes
versions of everything,
for chicken.
Right? Yeah.
And then you have to cull through that. And then not, you know, there's a high percentage of recipes that don't work or just aren't what you expected. And so I thought, well, you know, my business partners and I have a really good understanding of cooking and making a good recipe and teaching. And so I thought, well, this could be something that would help teachers. Now, I'm thrilled to hear Karen talk about this because it just it makes me so very happy to know that it's being used in so successfully in a classroom. And we do have a lot of teachers that are using it in their classroom. And I have a lot of people that have subscribed from different school districts. And it's thrilling to me because I think that in general, cooking education is not always taught anymore. I think when I was growing up, my mom just let me do whatever we wanted to do in the kitchen. It was not a big deal. She's a great cook. And she just let us go for it, and that's how I got into cooking. But so many times I think a lot of parents don't know how to cook anymore, and they eat out a lot, and there's so many convenience foods available. But this is a great way to get people back in the kitchen, and it's an important skill to have. So I'm thrilled that so many different students are using it too, not just special ed students, but general education students too.
Well, and Karen, you mentioned that Thanksgiving meal, and I think a lot of us bring a lot of anxiety to preparing a Thanksgiving meal, and the idea of preparing a Thanksgiving meal for 40 people just raises my blood pressure just thinking about that. So tell me about this. This is a really ambitious plan.
Well, you know, this is our second year of doing it, and the kids are so excited, and I think part of it is that they have been successful at doing smaller meals that they have no anxiety whatsoever. They're just like, what do we have to do? And let's go and do it. Let me tell you, there is no grumbling when it comes time to cook. And again, we're taking that Thanksgiving meal and we are multiplying by 10, multiplying by 3, so that we are putting in those academic subjects as well. So the students are making dinner for 40 tomorrow, and they're also going to be practicing their hosting skills. And it's so exciting to see staff members come up to our kids, telling them how much they're looking forward, and general education kids saying, hey, how come I'm not invited, and how do I get invited to this? So it's really a wonderful thing. And I would just like to say something. One of the great things about Look, Cook, and Eat is those recipes are put together so that they are nutritionally based. So much of cooking in the past for special education has been things that, like macaroni and cheese, which I absolutely love. But, when our students are outside of the schoolroom, we want them to be focusing on those nutritional meals. And Look, Cook, and Eat is a vehicle in which a child can, or a student can, put together a whole meal that not only tastes fantastic, but looks fantastic as well.
And is nutritionally balanced.
You're right.
And what's on the menu for Thanksgiving?
Oh, we have turkey and stuffing casserole, green bean casserole. We've made 8 pumpkin pies. We have a ham. We have cranberries and mashed potatoes. Oh, good stuff, good stuff.
Sounds
and
awesome.
There's a couple of little surprises in there, including a little play and gifts that the students made for each of their invitees. So, yeah, it's going to be a fun day.
I can't wait to see pictures.
Yeah.
Well, and before we run out of time, Sue, when people subscribe to the magazine, and you mentioned all of the different recipes that they get per magazine, since this is such a visual medium, and going back to these videos, do they also get access to the whole backlog of all the videos that you've done in the past?
Yeah, you get, as soon as you subscribe, you have access to everything that we've produced. So, it's just a catalog. Since we've only been launched for a year, we're working on our 6th issue right now. We come out bi-monthly, and we're working on a lot of different other ideas for Look, Cook, and Eat, and so I'm very excited. I can't really talk about them yet, but we're really cooking up, no pun intended, we're cooking up some really great ideas, and I'm very excited for what's ahead. But yes, as soon as you subscribe, you have access to all of the things we've done, and that's it's just going to keep
growing. Well, it's like a video-based cookbook. And just thinking about this, you couldn't have done this in traditional magazine form.
No, and that's the reason we went digital, because we needed to be able to use video and photographs. And when you can do that with a print magazine, but you have to go to a website, you have to find the video. It's just there's a lot of different steps that are involved. And it's more cost effective when you do it all digitally as opposed to a print.
Well, I am sure it's a very, very exciting resource for a lot of people. Sue Haas, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Sue Haas is one of the co-founders of Look, Cook, and Eat, a digital magazine designed to help people with intellectual disabilities learn how to cook. Karen Lamb, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Karen Lamb is a special education teacher at Indianola Middle School. She uses Look, Cook, and Eat with her students. Talk of Iowa is produced at Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, Dennis Reese, and Emily Woodbury. We had production assistance today from Divine Huff. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.